Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this Featured Voices podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is July 11th, 2019. Today, we're going to be discussing economics, macroeconomics, monetary policies, and the future. Just yesterday, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, spoke in front of the House Financial Services Committee and all but promised a rate cut, or maybe two. Financial assets, stocks and bonds, did what they were supposed to do. They rose in price, made the wealth gap a little bit wider, a side feature of current monetary policy that Mr. Powell disavows. He waffled about that when asked directly, denied it, and went on from there. Today, we have a very special guest that many of our listeners have been asking for and whom we've been seeking to get on the program for a while. Martin Armstrong is an economic forecaster, former hedge fund manager, a monetary and foreign exchange currency expert, and a deep student of history. He's advised central banks, powerful political leaders, and testified before congressional committees on economic cycles, monetary issues, currency issues, things like that. Mr. Martin Armstrong is the developer of the Armstrong Economic Confidence Model, which we're going to talk to him about, best known, perhaps, for calling the crash of 1987 to the very day. The model then went on to do a lot of great things, including pegging the June 13th to June 14th, 2011 moment as the start of a long-term upward trend in the market. The market obliged by notching its very first weekly rise right after that, and hey, here we are many years later. He's had remarkable success at calling major turning points in his model and ability to communicate really clearly in writing and in person has brought him world renown. Mr. Martin Armstrong, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Martin, let's give our listeners a solid grounding for the rest of the interview. Could you please explain for us what the economic confidence model is and how its output might be interpreted and used?
It's really a worldwide business cycle. And effectively, what really happens is behind the curtain, everybody knows that it's really confidence that drives things. So, I mean, you can see every crash, for example, 1929, Herbert Hoover comes out and says, oh, everything's fundamentally sound. I mean, you know, Reagan said the same thing. They always do. Why? Because can you imagine if the president came out and said, oh, you know, this thing's really going to crash. It's going to go down 90%, you know, hide underneath your bed. I mean, everybody would just absolutely panic. So it's always a confidence situation where they are trying to get everybody to believe that something's going to happen. This is really the way central banks operate. They know it's really a confidence issue. So that's why I named it the economic confidence model, because that's really what happens. As a trader, my whole life, I mean, everybody's always said, you know, you buy the rumor and you sell the news. It doesn't really matter what even the fundamentals are. I mean, I was called in with the 87 crash into the Brady Commission, et cetera. And you know, they always start with the same thing. They say, oh, we're going to find the guy that shorted this market, you know. And I just looked at him and I said, you realize that every investigation has begun that way since 1907. And nobody has ever found that mythical big short player. And he looks at me and he says, you know, this is a professor who taught it, you know, I think at Harvard at the time. And he says, well, you know, I said, let's put the accolades aside. All right. What is the issue? You know, how is somebody going to overpower the market? He says, well, I borrow a stock from this guy and I sell it to this guy. I said, correct. So the first guy is still long and now the second guy is long. So how can somebody outnumber the longs? And he just looks at me, you know, and I said, you know, take the futures market. Every contract's got to be matched. And he just looks and he says, well, what makes it go down? I said, very simple. I said, you've never traded, have you? really what happens is the majority of the people are along. Something happens, it scares them, they try to sell, and what happens? We call it no bid. You know, and that's what you get these huge gaps for. And unfortunately, people in government and academics, they have never traded. I mean, they don't know what this is about. Yet they stand up, want to make regulations, etc. And, you know, it's just absurd. The 87 crash, I mean, I really didn't even want to get involved. But friends were saying, you know, look, you got to go, otherwise you're going to take our computers away. They were blaming computer trading. And the investigation, what it revealed, was that, yes, there were, you know, a lot of people were starting to use computer models, and the computers were correct. They said sell. But the traders, they're looking at this and say, well, the Dow's already down 500 points. I can't sell into the low. There'll be a bounce. I'll sell the bounce. You know, and they did not believe the computers, and they unplugged them. The market crashed. And so it wasn't the computer trading. It's the simple fact that if everybody is long and they try to sell and nobody has the courage to step up and buy a falling knife, to catch a knife, unless you are short. So effectively, you have all these governments, they always want to outlaw short selling because, oh, that's what makes the market go down. But they're the only people that buy during a crash. So you outlaw that and it gets worse. The Great Depression, basically what was happening, the Senate had investigations. They were calling everybody up to testify before Congress. You know, from Rockefeller on down, were you short, were you this? They turned it into almost as if you were a trader. So the market fell 90% because nobody was short. You know, that was, if you shorted, you were afraid you're going to be called into the Senate and said, why did you sell against the country? You know, it's just absurd. But, you know, you have Europe doing the same thing, trying to outlaw short selling on bonds. Unless you actually have the bonds, you can't do anything. They think this is what supports the market, and it doesn't. It destroys free markets, and it makes Europe absolutely a disaster.
Well, let's talk about the free market. You have a lot of great points in here, and I want to get to the computerized trading, also what we think of that word markets now and whether it deserves one or maybe two sets of quote marks around it, given all that's happened monetarily. But your economic confidence model then is looking for cycles, and you said fundamentals don't really matter. Is that, if I interpret that correctly, is that because your study of history and what the model is projecting is that there are cycles that are going to come and go, regardless of things like fundamentals or even monetary policy?
Yeah, look, people act in anticipation. So what happens is, it's very interesting, is that if you think the stock market's going to go up 20%, you'll borrow and you'll pay 5, maybe even 10. If you think the stock market's not going to go up even 1%, you will not borrow at 1%. So we've done studies on this. I mean, the stock market has never peaked with the same level of interest rates twice because markets trade in anticipation. And that's what I mean that with the 87 crash, one of the things that was found, the market's down, the worst possible thing happened. Even professionals, they called the broker on the floor and they said, what is going on? And the broker said, I have no idea. When there's no information, now basically everything that you could ever possibly imagine runs through everybody's minds. I mean, there were rumors that the president was shot with a bullet dipped in cyanide, that Russia just invaded Europe and it was a news blackout, but somebody understood. I mean, so when you get these kind of crazy things, then what's a professional going to do? If he has no idea what's happening, the conservative thing is do you get out. You know, if the Fed raises interest rates, lowers interest rates, as a professional, you know, okay, fine, there'll be a knee-jerk reaction back. Nobody panics. But markets always trade in anticipation. If you think there's going to be, you know, take the dot-com bubble. Oh, this is going to be the greatest thing ever since, you know. And, you know, you get the cryptocurrency thing and the Bitcoin. People buy on anticipation, not the fundamental. I mean, if you look at the fundamentals in both cases, they're kind of crazy. You know, and dot-com back then, they're anticipating profits coming for the next 20 years, not currently. So that's what people don't understand. But markets run on anticipation. So if you, it's a confidence issue. If you believe in the future, you will buy. If you do not, you will not. So this is why quantitative easing has completely failed. For 10 years, they've lowered interest rates. They tried to punish people going negative, etc. It has not worked. Why? Because they don't believe in the future. Taxes in Europe are way too high. I mean, I go to, you know, to Europe often. If I go to Zurich and I buy a Starbucks, it costs me $10. The same thing in the United States costs me $5. You've got a 20% sales tax on everything, and that's minimum. That, I mean, it's just crazy. So there's been studies out now that show the Germans, yes, Germany's the strongest economy. The German citizen has less net worth than an Italian because the taxes are so high.
Well, let me ask you a market structure question. Then I do have a lot of trading in my background, and I discovered sometime around 2007 or 8 these trading strategies I'd learned very carefully were getting blown to pieces. And it took me a little while to figure out that I was trying to trade against computers that had much better access to information and obviously a much faster execution speed. So things became untenable. I couldn't quite work it out and I had to back away. So my theory is that market prices today are really principally the output of computer algorithms, not humans, right? Greed and fear, mostly replaced today by statistically driven, risk-adjusted, and essentially emotionless programmatic lines of code. What do you make of the idea that markets today are not really subject maybe to the same forces as in times past? In other words, are prices today delivering maybe less useful information than they have in the past?
No, I mean, in fact, it might sound a bit strange, but this type of intraday trading back and forth, it actually increases the risk of a crash. Because what happens is, yes, they can outperform you on day trading back and forth, but they don't hold positions. All right, so the real danger here is that they're in and out, correct. However, if they get trapped, they are not position oriented. So what will happen is that these and algorithms will suddenly leave these people long or short in the middle of a complete crisis and they can't get out. So it all depends. You know, if you're looking at intraday trading and these types of algorithms that are simply looking at it scalping back and forth, that's very nice. It will add some liquidity to the market, but it will not change the trend, and because they're not position trading. So if you're looking at a major crash type thing, they really increase the risk. Because they can get trapped, and the computer is not, those types of programs are not oriented to actual position trading. So that's a different type of thing. The biggest problem we have is that the liquidity has been shrinking. And so you have a lot of the banks have been curtailing proprietary trading. So that's been shrinking dramatically, like Deutsche Bank, for example. and then you have the whole situation of, you know, you have all these people constantly saying, oh, the stock market's going to crash and all this. And they've been utterly, completely wrong. Why? Mainly, if you look at it, the retail participation in the stock market is still about 50 to 60% of what it was in 2007. So the retail market is still not back in this thing yet. Nobody believes the rally. The vast majority kept, every new high, that's it. It's going to crash any day. And they have not understood what this market's about.
Well, what is this market about?
It's much more on a global scale now.
Mm-hmm.
You take what Powell said. You have to really understand what he said yesterday. All right. He emphasized not that the U.S. economy is in trouble. Yes, unemployment, things of this, and the economy is still strong. Why? Because the rest of the world is imploding. So if you look at the capital flows, everything's been moving into the United States. If you just look at France, take Germany, those two stock markets, where are the peaks? 2000. They still have not exceeded the 2000.com bubble high. The markets are telling you something. The same thing over in Greece and Italy, et cetera, that they have been bashing basically the free markets all along. You have people that like saying, Trump's creating a trade war, et cetera. Not really. He has been trying to negotiate. He negotiated with France. He says, all right, fine, I'll tell you what, with all of Europe, I'll drop all tariffs. You do the same. France immediately said, no way. Mm-hmm. It's more than people really understand. I mean, it's the capital flows have been moving into the United States from Europe dramatically and also from China. That was the whole issue behind Bitcoin. The Chinese government, more than 80% of the volume was all coming out of China because the Chinese figured out, their currency restraints. I can't get my money out of the country, so I'll buy Bitcoin, and then I'll sell it on another terminal outside the United States, and voila, we're outside of China, and I got my money. That's what's been going on.
Well, let's talk about the global flows for a second, because we had the December lows, right? And Powell did his famous double cave, right? Both on the balance sheet and also the interest rates. But let's look at this from a global standpoint. I look at that, and today we have people saying, oh my God, bonds are saying this, stocks are saying that. And what they're talking about is an inverted yield curve in the United States. They're talking about $13 trillion of negative yielding debt, most of it sovereign, across the world, and saying, look at that, that's pointing to weakness. But I say, look, we saw stocks and bonds go up. I'm detecting lots of financial easing and new liquidity. I think that's what I'm seeing in this. And then it sloshes around the globe a bit, but I don't think that's possible. Here's my theory. I don't think it's possible unless there was significant new liquidity added to the marketplaces by the central banks. Is that a plausible idea, or do stocks or bonds have it wrong here?
No, I mean, what's happening is it's a shift, and the real serious money is beginning to realize, hey, there is a major problem here. The central banks are trapped. All right. You see, the Fed was yelling at Draghi and say, look, we have to raise interest rates. Draghi, no, et cetera. And so the U.S. was the only one to raise interest rates, and they're getting bashed by the IMF, by everybody. Oh, you're pushing everybody else under. Draghi took interest rates down for more than 10 years, and nothing has happened. You would think that somebody would at some point wake up and say, hello, maybe this doesn't work. What has happened? The ECB now owns 40% plus of the national debts of Europe. They have also come out and said, unlike the Fed, which said they're going to allow the whatever they bought to mature and just expire, the ECB realizes it can't do that. If it were to do that, interest rates would rise dramatically. So whatever they have already bought, they have to continue to roll. And then to try and stimulate, what are they doing? All they're doing is buying government debt. So they have successfully managed to keep the governments on life support, but it's not filtering off into the economy. This at the same time, you have the fiscal side saying, "Oh well, gee, we have to, disparity between the rich and the poor, and we have to raise more taxes." Well, it's very nice, but it's also the rich who create the jobs through investment. So and then you take the pension funds in Europe, that's even worse. I mean, some of them have restraints where they must invest 80% in government bonds. I mean, the pension crisis that's coming is just off the charts. Look at Illinois. I mean, it's California. I mean, CalPERS used to be the largest, most profitable pension fund, in the United States. It's been losing money. You have a serious problem here where the government has done nothing but stimulate by buying its own stuff. So you have to really just look around and open your eyes a little bit. What's been going on? You have pension funds have been going out and buying farmland. Why? Because they're renting it out and getting 5%. They need to make money. Another crisis that's waiting to happen is they needed yield, so they were running into emerging markets. And they only got scared after Turkey. So the whole thing is just one giant mess. And this is not going to end nicely. So the stock markets are moving up because it's the only place to put money. I mean, yes, you can buy gold, but that's for the retail person. I mean, you're talking about sizable money for pension funds and institutional. It's stock market's the only place to go. So that's why the market has been constantly knocking on heaven's doors. And look, the Dow, I don't see it going anywhere, but up. I mean, we're probably looking at a release 35,000 or so, maybe by 2021, and if not higher. It's a difference at this point between public and private. The central banks can't raise interest rates. If they raise interest rates, they actually start going belly up. Now, people don't realize because they always think that they judge everything by the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is completely structured differently. The ECB has to go back and get permission to increase debt, et cetera. It's got all kinds of rules, whereas the Fed does not. So it's a different structure completely, and the ECB can actually go bankrupt if the politicians can't agree to increase its budgets. There you go.
Well, in the ECB too, if they have a capital call, it's got to go out to countries like Greece and Italy, right? So that would be like, how do you get money from a place that's broke to fund a place that's broke? It's kind of tricky.
I was actually one of the people involved and called in when they were forming the euro. And I can tell you, they attended all our World Economic Conference in London, et cetera. And I sat down with them. I said, okay, fine. If you want to create a single currency, you have to consolidate the debt. Now the euro will be able to compete with against the dollar. Why is the dollar the reserve currency? Simply because an institution can call up and say, okay, fine, buy me $2 billion with the treasuries. No problem. How can they do that in Europe? They can't. They have to, let's see. Let me look at Germany. Every country, although it's a single currency, every country has its own credit risk. The same thing as we have 50 states here. Yes, we have a dollar, but that doesn't mean that every state is equal and equivalent to each other. And that's the problem in Europe. They would not consolidate the debt. And on top of that, that's why you had bail-ins. Because suddenly Germany said, oh, gee, we're not going to put in money to bail out Italian banks. So they wouldn't consolidate the debts. They wouldn't pretend they're one happy big family, but they're not. They don't trust each other. So they won't put in any money if the Italian banks go down. So what do? They come up with a new policy. Oh, bail-ins. That's a good idea.
Hmm. Yeah, we'll see how that works. Now, Martin, a view I have is that markets do need price discovery. Price discovery needs markets. Two sides of a coin. Therefore, if you destroy price discovery, you've kind of messed with the markets. So I talked about the $13 trillion of negative yielding bonds, but more specifically, let's make this, that's a big number. Nobody understands $13 trillion, right? In Europe, we have the stunning fact that there are now, at last count, 14 junk-rated companies whose bonds are trading with a negative yield. And there's only one interpretation for that, right? If you hold that to maturity, guaranteed loss. If the company goes belly up, guaranteed loss. The only way you can come out ahead on that is to sell it to somebody else at an even more negative yield in the future. So it seems to me that when you talk about the expectations and the confidence, the fact that there are junk-rated companies in Europe with a negative yield tells me that there are people out there with a lot of confidence that the Central Bank of Europe is going to be able to continue to do what it's been doing, which is to continue to drive yields more deeply negative. Is that a fair interpretation? And what happens next?
Now, there's another twist to this. And the thing is that virtually every government is defaulted and their debt is worthless. And that goes back to Babylonian days. All right. So, the problem is that a government defaults, you get nothing. Absolutely zero. All right, you can't go running down to the National Gallery and start lifting out Picassos or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's it. Private debt, however, is substantially different. And if you bought General Motors and their profits are absolutely negative, et cetera, if they go bust, it goes into bankruptcy, you get some of your money back. All right, you're buying tangible assets. This is what the takeover boom was in the 80s. All right, it was another thing they were blaming me for, but effectively we had charts, so you can find them on our website. We showed that the book value of the Dow bottomed in 1977. And if you could buy a company, sell its assets and double your money or more, how could the market possibly be overvalued? And that's what the 1980s was all about. People suddenly realized that, wait a minute, the book value of these companies is more than what it's actually trading at. So you had the Dow go from 1,000 to 6,000, really, within a matter of a few years. We're back at that point in time where the private assets, even if the company is negative, et cetera, not doing so well, what's its book value? If you actually look, and you can go to our site as well, we've published like the P.E. ratio, the S&P back to inception. Where is the high? The high is actually at the bottom of the market in 2009. Why? Because at that point in time, people don't trust the banks. They don't necessarily trust the government. I'll buy equities. I'm not expecting to make 5% on my equities. I just want my money back. So you get at those points in time, and this is what's happening now with the equity side. It's not necessarily economic growth or what they expect in profits, et cetera. It's where can I put my money that I think I'm at least going to get the majority of it back? Europe is in serious, serious trouble. And Italy's kind of like moving towards creating a two-tier monetary system. I mean, this is what happens historically. Great Depression, there were over 200 cities in the U.S. that issued their own currency. You had the same thing, they're called Notgeld, in Germany during the hyperinflation period. Companies were issuing their own currency. They always go for a premium versus the government. And if you look at what survived the hyperinflation of Germany, all right, it was real estate and corporate assets. When they came out with the new currency in 1925, it was backed by real estate. So you reach these points where it's tangible assets versus anything on the public side. And I strongly advise everybody, do not own any municipal bonds, state bonds. The Fed, U.S. Treasuries are probably good still for another 2 to 3 years. After that, you know, forget it. Because what will happen is that you start getting a couple municipal defaults, and then it spreads like a contagion. They start looking around and say, oh, gee, who's next? This is what happened with Greece. As soon as Greece got in trouble back in 2010, the markets made a lot of money, traders, okay, fine. Then they looked around and said, that's interesting. Who's next on the list? Oh, Portugal, yeah. Then Spain and Italy. Then they even went after France. That's how capital moves. It's a contagion. And you're going to read 1931 chapter, Herbert Hoover's memoirs. He explains the same exact thing. He says, capital acted like a loose cannon on the deck of a ship in the middle of like a hurricane. He said, shooting off in every which direction, they so fast they couldn't even form a committee to figure out what was going on. Once Austria defaulted, that's it. Oh, Germany was next. Everybody ends up defaulting. Even Britain went into a moratorium. So it's a contagion. And so once you get that first crack, that's it. The only thing that's going to go up are private assets.
And let's explore that a little bit. So obviously, we had a long up cycle here. And I'm wondering, first question is, where are we in that cycle in terms of your economic confidence model? And second, when it does finally turn the corner, something you said earlier, let me see if I can phrase it correctly. If you know, the central banks might be able to wiggle things around at the margin, but they can't change the trend. So when this trend changes, you're saying here that private assets are going to be a better place to be than public assets, especially not muni, not state, things like that. Maybe treasuries, but maybe not euro area sovereign debt, things like that, if I've captured all that right. So when this turns, what do you think this looks like?
It looks like we're heading that the next business cycle on this economic confidence model bottoms in January. So the next wave is basically an 8.6 year wave. So this one has been deflationary, which is why, you know, the quantitative easing has failed, etc. The next one will be inflationary. So this is what the markets are starting to show you. Gold has kind of poked its head up finally. Mm-hmm. You know, unlike the gold bugs, I mean, you know, just listen to what they say. Oh, everything's going to crash and only gold's going to go up. Sorry, but the stock market has been making new highs with gold. All right. If you look at historically, it's the private versus the public. So gold will only move opposite of private assets when you're on a gold standard. When you're not on a gold standard, gold will move with the rest of the private assets. And both are moving up. All right, so the next wave, they're showing you what's coming. And the next wave is going to be an inflationary one. And that's probably going to run off into a peak around 2024. But we have serious problems heading in here. And I would say you have a major crisis coming on the monetary side. We'll probably see something similar to like an international meeting like Bretton Woods, et cetera, most likely by 2021 to 2022. Not that you're going back to a gold standard or something, but just that, you know, we are in a situation where the philosophy of currency is different between the United States and Europe. The U.S. always wants a cheaper dollar because they look at, okay, fine, the dollar's down, we can basically sell more goods. Mm. So the two times the dollar went up dramatically was during the Great Depression because everybody else was defaulting, and that's where FDR ends up devaluing the dollar. All right, when's the second time? 1985. All right, then what did they do then? They created the G5 at the Plaza Accord to lower the value of the dollar by 40%. U.S. always wants a cheaper dollar. Europe always wants a stronger currency. It's a philosophy that has emerged since World War II. When we were going to first open our offices in Europe back in 85, I went to lunch with a friend of mine who was head of one of the major Swiss banks. And I said, okay, fine, here's a bunch of names that we came up with for European advisors or something like that. And because I assumed there was still a lot of anti-Americanism in Europe. And he looked at me and he says, you know, name one European analyst. And I was very embarrassed because I couldn't. I said, you know, I'm thinking, oh, here I am, an arrogant American or something. And I said, look, I'm sure there is. I just don't know of anybody. And he laughed and he says, there are none. And I said, what? Why? You know, he says, the reason everybody uses you is because you don't care if the dollar goes up or down. He says, if he's French, it's vive la France. If he's British, it's God save the Queen. He says, and he was right. Then I started paying attention that because of all the currencies went to zero, the politicians in Europe said, vote for me, the Deutschmark's up, you know, 2 cents against the dollar. They used the currency as justification politically, whereas in the United States, nobody could run and say, vote for me because the dollar's up against the Mexican peso. They're going to go, yeah, what are you talking about? You know? Mm-hmm. In Europe, it was always a political issue. And even in 2007, when the euro, you know, and the euro is going to crash, etc., they put an economist in prison for a few months because he came out and said it was going to go down. You know, the euro, you know, I get emails all the time from guys that work in the top banks in Europe, and they all say the same thing. God, I wish I could say what you say. But they have to sign confidentiality agreements. They can't come out and say, you know, the euro is really screwed. It's going to go down very big. The ECB would be on the phone to that bank and fire that guy. So you never will get any kind of real analysis out of any of the major institutions because they're not allowed to.
Right. Right. Well, now, Martin, when you said a major crisis, a monetary crisis, maybe sometime 2021, 2022, somewhere in there, what are you speaking of? Are you speaking of a collapse of the euro? Are you maybe the yen? Or what does that look like to you? What do you mean by that?
Mostly both. And the only time you get a major crisis, as I said, like 1934 or 1985, yeah, is the dollar going up. When the dollar is pushed up, and that's when the U.S. government's going to come in. Look, this is, we can't take this. This is, we have to manipulate the currencies. We've got to do something. You got the similar situation problem with Hong Kong because they pegged it to the dollar. As the dollar goes up, they get deflation. contrary to everybody else in Asia, it's a real issue. And they don't understand what this is, and that's the real problem. It's the capital flows are moving into this country, and this is what Powell was talking about. The Fed is trapped between domestic policy objectives versus international. The U.S., he should not be lowering interest rates. Economy's doing well. Okay, stock market's up at highs. Why would you be lowering interest rates at this point in time? It makes no sense. All right. The only reason he's saying this is because the rest of the world is imploding. And everybody else is out here screaming, you got to lower interest rates, you're killing us. That's what's going on. So it's a major international crisis. And the dollar is going to be pushed up because the more these people refuse to reform, the capital just leaves. And I mean, look, I go to Brussels, and I mean, I meet with probably more governments than anybody in the world. And I just sit there sometimes in amazement. It's like Europe wants to take the trading of the euro away from Britain. Oh, you know, we can't allow then, you know, that to be the center. I said, so you're going to take it away from New York, Chicago, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and Shanghai? And they look at me and they go, well, no, just Britain. You know, what are you trying to do here? Are you trying to turn the euro into the new ruble or something, that it's constantly the same price and can't trade against you? This is what they, you know, it's when you mix politicians with economics, you get an absolute disaster.
That makes sense. Now, you said earlier that your cycle had called a bottom in January. That was a deflationary cycle. Next 8+ years, 8.4, I think, is an inflationary cycle. When I'm looking over at my indicators, my macro indicators here, I'm looking at a global economic slowdown at this point. And I'm, you know, measuring that with the Hong Kong air freight shipments, European banking, autos all across Europe, South Korea's exports, chips, China's PMIs. When I read those signals right now, I'm seeing a big slowdown. What are you seeing?
Yes, we're that's going straight into January of 2020. That's when the model bottoms at that point in time. And it's, and that's what I mean, that you have an implosion outside this country. But the inflationary type of cycle we see coming is different. This is not necessarily a demand-driven thing, but more of a cost-push type inflation. And, you know, you have serious weather conditions, which is basically going to be pushing up more on the on the food side, but you have a lot of capital shifting. And like I say, it's not a question of where it is before. Gee, I can make 5% in gold versus only 1% over here. It's irrelevant. It's more or less, once you have the confidence shifts, and we're at that point in time where we push this cycle as far as we can possibly go. I mean, what are you going to do? Lower interest rates to -20%? You know, already you have people calling for, you know, the elimination of cash. Lagarde is calling for that because they realize they can't lower interest rates negative, because people then take their money out of the banks and they store it in at home. I mean, sales of safes in Europe have been, you know, tremendous. but, you know, this is what's taking place. So instead of looking at their policies, it's like, well, okay, fine. We have failed because people can withdraw their money from the bank rather than spend it. You know, and you can't force people to spend money. If they have no confidence in the future, they're not going to spend it, period. So you're looking at people just taking, if you eliminate cash, then they will go out and they'll start buying anything else that they can just to get money in a situation where the assets will be off the grid.
Yeah, it would be a great time to hold all sorts of hard assets. If you told me I was facing -10% losses on my bank holdings, I'd want anything. I'd hold real estate, even if I had predatory, real estate taxation at that point. I would still judge that to be possibly a better deal. Now, here's the thing that I think central bankers, this is where I think they whiff big time, is they think in terms of all their models, and they've got a lot of fancy calculus and good stuff like that. Japan's theory was, hey, if we lower interest rates far enough, what we're going to do is we're going to encourage spending. And what they actually encouraged was savings. Is there a point at which, let me ask it this way, aren't interest rates already at a bound where if you push them lower, you don't just get more of the behavior you're wanting, you might get the opposite behaviors?
Yeah, I mean, it's Japan is an example. When they put in the sales tax, suddenly the economy looked like it was booming for about 60 days before, because everybody knew they're going to if they were going to buy anything, it was going to cost them 7% more. So they ran out and bought whatever they did. You got a nice little, you know, knee-jerk reaction up, and then the economy went straight down. People are not stupid. It's the same thing with real estate and interest rates. I warned that, okay, fine, that real estate would start going up only when you saw the interest rates going up. They said, oh, that's impossible, blah, blah, blah. Look, the average person is not stupid. Why should he go out and buy real estate as long as he sees the mortgage rates keep going down? As soon as he saw the first uptick, I better rush and go get that place now before it's too late. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know who makes up these theories, but they certainly had never walk out into the street, just talk to people.
Yeah. Yeah. So if we look at where we are in this macro cycle right now, how do you place gold into this? I know you said, okay, it's going up. Maybe that the markets and gold are starting to sniff out the next leg, which is an inflationary cycle. You know, gold to me has a little bit of correlation with inflation, but it seems to be really a safety valve, you know, against systemic crisis, things like that. How do you view gold? Is this really an inflation hedge to you, or is there a role for it?
No, I mean, gold has got really nothing to do with inflation. That's just been the biggest propaganda story I think I've ever heard. I mean, gold went down for 19 years and inflation went up. So, I mean, during the same period, the Dow went from 1,000 to 20-something thousand. Come on. I mean, it's, you know, I don't know where these people come up with these things, but they keep saying the same thing over and over and over again. And there is no such thing as a correlation to inflation. It that's just completely wrong. The inflation, there's many different types. There is a cost push inflation, which we called like stagflation in the 70s. It was not that demand was going up. It was just that because of OPEC and everything that had anything to do with plastic suddenly rose in price. So it wasn't rising because of a demand. It was rising because of a cost. And so there are many different types. It's not always the same thing. And, you know, you go into 1980, you know, when gold first hit 875, it was not the only thing. People were hoarding toilet paper back then. It was anything but, you know, that they could buy. They were buying. You know, and they felt that the dollar was going to be worth less. And so that's largely what you get into. And I think that's the type of cycle we're heading back into. The cost of all this is really quite dramatic. And, you know, and most of it, the deflation has been very prominent, mainly because of the rise in taxation. And people often don't look at that, but it's, you know, if I give you $100 and then I say, look, I need 80 back in taxes, did I give you 100 or did I give you 20 bucks? You know, and this is what's going on. What's the net take home? And if you look at, you know, women have basically lost the right to stay home and take care of the family. In the 30s, a family could be supported basically with one income. There wasn't an income tax. All right, now everybody pays about 50% in income taxes by between the sales tax and the state tax and et cetera. So now it takes two incomes basically to earn what one used to in the 30s. So, I mean, now the guy's got to make a lot of money for his wife to actually stay home and just take care of the kids. That's a luxury. It's no longer, you know, the way it was before. I mean, it's quite different. So, you know, we don't look at this, and they keep talking about the difference between the rich and the poor, and the gap is rising. Look, I was also working in Congress to revise the Social Security system. I spent a lot of time on it and to turn it into a national wealth fund back in the 90s. And I went through this and said, okay, fine, this is what we do. This is how we take in people's track records, and we allocate money based upon that. The Democrats would not vote for it because they said, oh, gee, if they came in, they wanted to change the fund managers. I said, look, this has got nothing to do with who the guy voted for. Whoever has the best track record wins, okay? It's all political down there. So they would never vote for it, you know, and people say, oh, well, the rich make it and the poor don't. Oh, how do the rich make money? By investing. All right, Social Security is 100% invested in government bonds. All right, had it just been in the Dow. And when I was working on this, the Dow was 1,000. Social Security would not be a problem today. But, you know, this is it. I mean, we deprive the average person from investing. I mean, got all these nice regulations, et cetera, for pensions, et cetera. And then, you know, oh, no. It's risky being equities, government bonds. We have, you know, one major client who's a big pension fund, and they listened to us. They sold all their government bonds. And, you know, S&P went into audit, and they said, oh, you're taking on more risk. And they said, look, they showed them our study, and they said, we did their own. They did their own due diligence. They said, you're absolutely right. We have less risk with private than we do with government. And we're being much more conservative. S&P didn't know what to say. They walked out and left their rating alone. This is it. I mean, it's like, why is government debt AAA? I mean, no government's ever paid.
Interesting. Now, this that's just fascinating. So this this idea of cost push inflation showing up in your models, it aligns with my own work, which is I do a lot on oil and gas, but mostly oil being the prime lubricant of the globalized economy. And you look at there's about $1.4 trillion missing dollars of upstream oil and gas exploration because the price of oil plummeted in 2014 below the cost of exploration, supporting exploration. So guess what? We didn't invest. There's a lag. It's not like farming. It's farming with a 5 to 7 year lag. So you push those timeframes out a little bit and you discover that unless the world's in some kind of major demand destroying depression / recession, there's going to be a real oil shortage showing up at some point right around 20, 21, 22, somewhere in that zone. And there's not a lot we can do about it. It takes a long time to get those FIDs up and out, and there's, you know, tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions involved. So it just takes time. It takes a lot of money. It's just both of those things have been missing in action for a while. So I'm wondering if are you looking at all do commodities, in particular, is oil? How do those factor into your cost push analysis?
Yeah, most of them are in that same position. The same thing with agricultural. Mm-hmm. I mean, just look at Alberta. I mean, Alberta's, you know, you have a rising situation there of separating from Canada because they had been bashed and ground into the ground, basically, by all the environmentalists that have done everything possible to stop any kind of energy output out there. Canadian oil goes so cheap because it's got to be trucked out of there. And the cost of trucking everything out rather than a pipeline, that's the problem. And, you know, you have a lot of these, I mean, the same things in Europe. I mean, you have, you know, moves to basically eliminate all short-term flights. And it's the whole thing is just really, really crazy. I mean, Europe, whatever it can possibly do to destroy its own economy, it is doing very cleverly and right on time.
All right. So as we look forward into the future, I'm sure a lot of this for you is part of what you offer at your World Economic Conference. I understand there's one coming up in Orlando, Florida. Last one, I think, before that was where? Was that? That was in Rome?
Yes. In fact, Nigel Farage from Britain came in. He was our guest speaker over there.
Nice.
It was quite interesting. And he stood up. He says, "Of course, I'm going to come here." He says, You guys are the alternative to Davos, he called us.
I like it. Alternative to Davos. So you're this one in Orlando, Florida, October 25th, 26th. And I see here that if people go to armstrongeconomics.com, go to the events page, there's a link there for tickets. We'll put a link to it as well under this podcast. So tell people what they will find there and what they'll get from it.
Basically, these are literally international events. I mean, generally we have between 30 to 40 different countries people attending. And we cover the entire world to basically show what the world is actually doing. And so you can see what the trends are. Because the biggest problem with, I think, analysis in general is that these people that predominantly put things out, they live in a cocoon. I mean, they don't even look at what's happening outside the United States. And everything is relevant. And the reason the U.S. economy has been doing well is because Europe is an absolute basket case. So capital has been moving over in this direction. I mean, you can just, look at, like I said, a yearly chart of the French stock market. The peak's 2000. The markets are telling you something's seriously wrong in Europe. And that's what's going on. So we basically show the entire world so you can actually see what the capital flows are all about, mm-hmm. where it's going. And look, there's generally probably about $3 trillion sitting in the room. We have pension funds from around the world. I mean, we have a cocktail party that we do generally on the midnight, and then everybody, it's like people have been attending these things since 1985. So it's quite interesting. It's an interesting place to meet a lot of people and connections, and it's almost like an alumni, really. But you get to see the world capital flows right there in the room. I mean, I remember even back in 1985, the guy from, we had a delegation from Saudi Arabia there, and they're saying they wanted to invest in Canada, and the guy from Canada stands up, he says, "What do we have that you would want to invest in?" He says, "You got all the water." So you get to see how everybody's looks at things. The grass is always greener someplace else.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, how many people are typically in attendance? You said 40 countries. Is this intimate or fairly large?
The Orlando one, yeah. Now it's usually around 600 to 800.
Mm-hmm.
We try not to go beyond that because then it gets a little too big. Our overseas ones aren't quite as large. They're generally around between 300 to 400. Not everybody wants to fly into the United States these days. But, they're good events. You get to meet a lot of people from around the world.
All right. Well, excellent. It sounds like a really great time. I've never had the great fortune of attending one yet, but I'll correct that at some point in the future. And if anybody's interested, you find that again at armstrongeconomics.com. And Martin, is there any other way that people can or should be following your work?
No, just basically go to the website. That's pretty much it. The main thing that we basically do is we have an artificial intelligence computer system which actually writes all the reports. It produces forecasting reports on over 1,000 instruments every day from around the world, and we cover everything from like Romania to everywhere around the world, and the computer writes everything. So it's the only fully artificial intelligence system in the world.
Fantastic. Well, very interesting. Well, Martin, this website, fascinating. Interview, fascinating. So thank you very much for that. Thank you for your time. And I hope we can do it again at some point in the future.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.